Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Jim, are you familiar with game theory?
I am familiar with game theory, Patrick. I mean, on the surface, game theory is the study of mathematical models of strategic interaction among rational decision makers. It can be valuable for predicting behavior and incentivizing decisions that improve a broader system. In my opinion, the biggest issue with game theory is that, like most other economic models, it relies on the assumption that people are rational actors that are self-interested and utility maximizing. Of course, we are social beings. All right, Patrick, I understand you have something special planned for these next two episodes of Rockin' the Suburbs. Let me introduce myself first, and then I'll turn it over to you. So I am Jim Lenihan, and with me, of course, is, as always, is...
Patrick Foster, yes.
There you
and,
go.
And thank you, Jim. This one here is one of those ones. As I've been working on this, I've been reminded of what we always tell people when we do our listener correspondence. We're going to get to it eventually.
That's right.
And so
I think we're good on that.
Yeah.
You know.
And so, you know, not wanting to cheat anybody out of anything we worked on. And also, we thought that these two episodes coming up are about the band Game Theory, led by Scott Miller,
okay.
A band that started in early 82 and ran till about 89, and then sort of morphed into another band, which we're not going to get into today. But about a year ago, a record came out that was part of a reissue series on the band Game Theory. And what it did was kind of tied up all the very last demos that the last version of the band had done. It was called Across the Barrier of Sound. And when that came out, actually, our guest from yesterday plays a key part in this, which is why we're kind of putting it here. Bill Davis hooked me up with a writer that he had known just from all his time in Dash Rip Rock called Brett Milano, who wrote a book on game theory and Scott Miller. So I was able to interview him almost a year ago, interestingly enough. And through him, I got in touch with another writer named Annie Zaleski, who wrote the liner notes for this game theory project. So I'm not sure how familiar people are with game theory. You know, maybe a little, you know, maybe some, maybe you were, you know, into college rock in that time, and they were pretty popular in certain pockets. But anyway, basically what this is going to be is kind of a little narrative history of game theory from 82 to 89, broken up into two parts and interspersed with these interviews I did with Annie Zaleski and Brett Milano.
Okay. So I guess just take it away.
Let's hit play and we'll see what we got. January of 1979, and students at the University of California, Davis have just returned from winter break to begin their spring semester. Among them is a freshman named Scott Miller, who will eventually graduate with a degree in electrical and computer engineering. His real passion, though, is for music. And Davis, like many colleges in America at the time, had a campus radio station that was a mind-expanding lifeline for a relatively small group of music obsessives. Here's Brett Milano, Boston-based music writer and author of Don't Thank Me All at Once, The Lost Genius of Scott Miller.
I guess, I was around that also time going to college in Amherst, Mass, and we had a lot of the same circuit. We had, you know, we had a college radio station. We had a certain amount of people who congregated around it and also were responsible for bringing bands to campus. And Scott in Davis got a lot of the same bands we would get in the Northeast. He just got them at a different time. But having all these records come into your life on a regular basis on college radio was part of the experience. Seeing the bands was part of the experience. And for some people, that meant, you know, going off and realizing you were free to do it yourself and follow your music, which is what he and a lot of other people at that time did.
Miller would go on to work at the UC Davis station, along with one Steve Wynn. Yes, the one who would go on to form the Dream Syndicate. And Game Theory is sometimes held up as a classic example of a 1980s college rock band. Miller was forming his songwriting chops and learning about being in a group with a band called Alternate Learning, which opened shows for touring acts that played at the college and would release an EP in 1979 and a full length in 1981. They also had a pretty decent following on the Davis campus. But it's the group that he formed after Alternate Learning disbanded in 1982 that's our focus today, Game Theory. Version 1.0 of the band was assembled by mid-1982 and featured Miller as guitarist and vocalist, Nan Becker, who had been in Alternate Learning, on keyboards, Fred Juhos on bass, and Michael Irwin on drums. The name referenced mathematical models and strategic planning, but Miller told Milano for his book that he liked the name because people think, quote, we can apply rules to our lives and it will all work out. There's something comedic about that because it's so untrue. Life is just hopelessly complicated, end quote. Game Theory was the first flowering of Miller's unique ability to combine ironic, darkly humorous, and cerebral lyrics with his intense love of power pop and all kinds of music from the Beatles onward. His other gift was never obviously wearing his musical influences on his sleeve. Here's Brett Milano again.
I think part of his genius was that he could absorb so much music and refer to it, and he never rewrote anything. There's not a single kind of cute rephrasing of some other song anywhere in his catalog. He did it with lyrics. You know, he'd play on other people's lyrics and titles, Cortex the Killer, that kind of thing. He never rephrased a song. That was kind of too easy.
Blaze of Glory, the band's debut LP, was recorded in Scott's bedroom and mixes a before-its-time lo-fi aesthetic with bits of jittery new wave, Ramones power chug, and cool male-female harmonies, all shot through with a youthful zest. Even in this early phase, Miller's song titles were singular. Bad Year at UCLA, The Young Drug, The Girls Are Ready to Go. And one track, Sleeping Through Heaven, even has an off-kilter soul vibe.
I know.
LP was issued on Scott's own Rational Records. And to add a further DIY touch, the album came in a white plastic trash bag sealed with a twist tie. It didn't make a particularly big impact, with selected reviews and not much radio play given its fairly limited distribution. Miller, and to a lesser degree Juhos, were busy writing new songs, and the band was playing pretty much any local show they could get. They had their sights set on recording new material, and a change in drummers proved fortunate in that regard. Dave Gill's cover band was opening a show for Game Theory, and he heard that Irwin was on his way out from the drum kit. He volunteered his services and got the gig, eventually letting Miller know that he and his friend had converted his garage into a studio space they called Samurai Sound Lab. And in no time at all, it had become Game Theory's rehearsal space and the place where they recorded their next two records. They were both EPs, and the first was a six-song offering called Pointed Accounts of People You Know, released in 1983, again on the Rational label. Miller composed three songs on side one, while Juhos penned two on the flip side, with a Miller-Nan Becker collaboration rounding it out. The songs showed some growth and hints of Miller's increasingly distinctive style. Music writer Annie Zaleski, who has written liner notes for some of the band's reissues, talked to me about where the roots of Miller's style lay.
Think of cult power pop bands. The Game Theory fits right in. They were sort of the next generation of that, honestly. Yeah. They really kind of, they just kind of were doing their own thing, but they're definitely kind of in that rich history.
Two of Miller's strongest songs gave the EP a solid 1-2 punch. The herky-jerky Penny, Things Won't, and Metal and Glass Exact. One of the rare early songs Miller considered any good, telling the interviewer at one point that, quote, it was sort of like mid-tempo Elvis Costello. In Brett Milano's book, Don't Thank Me All at Once, The Lost Pop Genius of Scott Miller, he describes how the second of Game Theory's EPs came about. And I quote, the second of the EPs, Distortion, benefits from Michael Caruso's tighter production and was arguably the one where Scott truly found his footing. The opening Shark Pretty was a prototype for many Game Theory rockers. The drum pattern would become one of the band's sonic touchtones. Shark Pretty and Juho's song Kid Convenience featured the band's first, and to some extent only, high-profile session guest. Guitarist Earl Slick was well known to them as a former and future David Bowie sideman, and he had wrapped up the Sirius Moonlight tour about 2 weeks before playing on the Game Theory EP. Milano goes on to write, quote, since the indelible pop hook would always be Miller's medium, Nine Lives to Regal Five marks his breakthrough, the first truly masterful one in his catalog. And of course, it comes attached to a lyric that references Apollo 13, quantum physics, and Star Trek, thus arguing that all those topics are worth the emotional investment of a great pop song.
Distortion, I saw in those shoes, I learned a kind of ease.
is the part of the episode where I turn back into the real Patrick you're probably used to hearing all the time. And I just want to say a few things, guys, about, you know, this early part of Game Theory's career. It's part of a career of a band that, if it was all there was to the band, you may not really even be listening to this episode, because it was the later records, the ones that I was so attracted to, the ones that really got me into the band, the ones that got them broader national attention and, you know, attention from other quarters, that really makes you go back and investigate this band. And it's one of the great things about pop music and rock music that we've talked about on this podcast a lot, the chance to go back and examine the early formative days. These records, you know, they sound a little thin compared to what came next. There are just glimpses here and there of an emerging sound, of an emerging major talent that Scott Miller was. And it's interesting, too, that, you know, during this time, the band had mainly played local shows in California, around Davis and Sacramento, occasionally a trip to San Francisco, and maybe one to Phoenix or somewhere in Arizona, I believe. But, you know, the band later had an energy, and you'll hear Annie talk about this and Brett, too. There was an ability of Game Theory, because they went out and started playing shows and touring, that they really translated that energy to the studio, and on top of it, really used the studio because of the producer they hooked up with to record their next record, which is really where the Game Theory legend really begins to bloom. Now, this wasn't the record that I got into Game Theory because of. That one we'll start tomorrow's episode with, and I'll start out in Patrick mode telling you a little bit about that discovery story. But I just want to catch up on a few things here. One, weirdly enough, in France, there was a compilation album released called Dead Center that compiled some stuff off the first album and a couple of the EPs and all that stuff. And secondly, it was in the summer of 1984, that epic summer, in July, that this lineup of the band, the one that recorded the two EPs, went into the studio with Mitch Easter to record their second full-length album, which ended up being called Real Nighttime. And we're going to talk about that record here in just a minute, and Brett and Annie will come back and help me out. But I want to say that before the record was released in 1985, this lineup of Game Theory went on tour for the first time nationally. And it was on that tour in the fall of 84 that things really happened. It was one of those first times out on the road, first time tours, and it quickly became apparent that it was not for everybody. And by the time the band got back to California, essentially, it was no longer that lineup anymore, and it would be a radically different one from then on. But we're going to talk about Real Nighttime a little bit here, and we're gonna tell you that on the cover of the record, there's not a photo of the group. There's just a picture of Scott playing an acoustic guitar, and you know, there are some interesting things about the way that went down. But I remember going back and finding this record and saying to myself, wow, this is where it really all started to come together. Let's hear Annie talk a little bit about Mitch Easter and why the connection between him and Scott Miller was so important, and where things went from there.
You know, Mitch Easter, besides being also a really kind of wonderful songwriter, you know, in Let's Active, and, you know, obviously he co-produced, you know, REM's Murmur and Reckoning. But he really was sort of the shepherd of this kind of unique pop music in the 80s. You know, he produced, and he still does this, you know, and he just kind of, I think he just really understood what Scott was going for. You know, I think they had kind of similar musical reference points, you know, but Mitch was also really good at sort of, you know, harnessing and kind of capturing what they were going for, you know, because if you have these songs are so dense that, you know, they go in all sorts of like interesting directions musically and lyrically. And Mitch was just really good at kind of going along for the ride and making sure it sounded good. You know, one of the things about Mitch Easter I love is that he just really captures great sounds from acts. And, you know, and it's not necessarily like, you know, obviously, if you're going to Mitch Easter, you probably have a particular sound in general. You know, if you are into power pop, you're like, I want to work with Mitch Easter. But, you know, at the same time, though, he's not, you know, he's not a cookie cutter producer. He's not someone who's going to, you know, put the Mitch Easter shine on everything. You know, you can recognize that it's probably produced by him, but he's just a really also a very smart producer. And so him and Scott were a good match in that sense.
According to Brett Milano's book, quote, one of Mitch's contributions was to lend an appealing pop shimmer to an album whose lyrical sentiments are rather dour. 24 concerns an early midlife crisis, and the final chorus, which adds a year to the singer's age, suggests it will go on a while. But the sound of the track, with some R.E.M. jangle in the guitars and some Beach Boys in the harmonies, is far more upbeat. Curse of the Frontier Land, lyrically the bleakest song on the album, with the oft-quoted line, "A year ago we called this a good time," manages to be out there and straight ahead at once. The album includes some nonsensical liner notes and is really rife with Scott Miller's incredible song titling. Here Comes Everybody, Waltz the Halls Always, If and When It Falls Apart, She'll Be a Verb. The album also includes a cover of Big Stars You Can't Have Me. Alex Chilton's influence was clear on both Miller and Mitch Easter, but the Big Star Association came to be a way for those who didn't really want to work hard enough to unlock the mysteries of Game Theory's songs to put a tag on the band as just another post-Big Star group. Here's Brett Milano.
I think in the early times there was definitely an influence. So you can hear it on Real Nighttime where there is an Alex Chilton cover. But I think, you know, as Scott went along, he really developed his own way of doing things.
Real Nighttime came out on Enigma Records, which for the first time got a Game Theory album into stores across the U.S., with plenty of copies sent to magazines and college radio DJs. The reviews were uniformly positive, and by mid-1985, Miller had relocated to San Francisco, where he rehearsed a new lineup. Shelley Lafreniere on keyboards, Gil Ray on drums, and Susie Ziegler on bass. That lineup hit the road in September of that year, sprinkling Game Theory magic in East Coast and Midwest clubs, following an increasingly common route for indie bands. With a sparkling record, a new lineup, plenty of shows to play and interviews to do, surely Game Theory were ready to follow the road to success taken by bands like The Replacements, Husker Du, and The Meat Puppets, or at the very least, find their way into record collections of suburban music freaks everywhere.
Okay, now you indicated this is a two-part.
That's right.
Project, mm-hmm. right, Patrick? Yep. So set people up for tomorrow, I
guess.
Yeah,
absolutely. We sort of took game theory up to a certain point in the mid-80s when they were a working band, as you heard, and touring, and had just come across a certain producer, Mitch Easter, who I think all of our fans know from his work with REM and other associated groups. And the rest of the story of where Game Theory went, how they were perceived, and certainly I think their most successful work is what we're going to focus on tomorrow.
Okay. All right. So you're going to want to tune in for that.
Yep.
Right. And of course, if anyone has comments, memories of Game Theory, mm-hmm. We'd love to hear from you because we could follow that up. And yeah. You can call, leave a message, 612-440-1984. Right. Or email us, rock@suburbspod.com, or make a comment on our Facebook or Twitter or Instagram.
Yeah.
Accounts. You'll find all those at Suburbs Pod. All right. Okay. Let's get on here and move on to tomorrow.
Great. Sounds good.
All right. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you all tomorrow.
It's funny, I thought you were going to ask me that.